Okay, let's begin. We have, you know, ample amount of space at least. So, what is on the agenda today? We are going to continue this small programming language example. It's probably, you know, slightly ill-selected example since the parsing part is rather large. It's, you know, more than 100 lines of code, which is huge amount of code. Parsers are quite easy to do. You have to have the grammar scores to actually write a nice parser, but writing it in Haskell is quite easy. So for this lecture, I decided to skip the, you know, final part of the parsing example, since, well, we kind of know how to parse things already. We know how to combine parsers into bigger ones, and completing the parser is just an exercise of writing more and more code. So no problem there. So what I did is I first completed the parser, made it complete. It parses the whole simple example language that I wrote. Then I made the language bigger. So I embiggened the language for this part. I added some things to these expressions that we are interpreting with our nice program interpreter or program calculator. We have this original expression type, which has plus, minus, multiplication, and constant integers. I added variables. V stands for a variable, so I can make x plus 1, that is now a statement in my language, or an expression in my language. Then I added let expressions, which are exactly the same as in Haskell. Let x be 7 in this other expression. So it's a bit more expanded. And why did I do this? Because I want to show you more applicative functors. And there's two parts in this system. One is to make the parser, which contains actually a single applicative functor, which is the parser data type. So that's one example. Then I go to the part where I interpret these expressions. I have read some program from a file, and then I, you know, evaluate the program. And it turns out that the evaluator part is also something that contains plenty of applicative functors if you look at it correctly. So this is the expansion of the types and other things. I also added a bit more to the language. I added statements. Statements like set x to value 7, print the value of x, and read a line from the user. And then this allows me to make programs, or very small and dummy programs, but still. A program is just a list of statements that get executed in that order. So nothing fancy, nothing theoretically nice, just a your run-of-the-mill microprogramming language. And here are a few examples how you would write this in a file. It's some kind of a weird bastardization of C and Haskell and what have you. We have expressions like numerical computations still. We have expressions that now contain the let statement. Let x be 7 in, let y be 4 in, blah, blah, blah. You get these huge nested statements. So, kind of like this. Almost the same as in Haskell, small differences so we don't confuse the languages. Then we have example programs like print number 5. Can't do hello world with this since I don't have strings in there. Then I can make larger programs by gluing smaller programs together with a semicolon. So I could have some program that prints the value of x, increments the x by 5, prints x again. No, just a simple example. And then there is this evaluator part of how you actually execute such a program, which is incomplete and the example for today. And then there is this parsing part, which has been expanded to take into account all of these you know, widgets that we can write there. And, you know, program is something that is separated by a new line or a string followed by semicolon followed by space, and it's either a set, print, or read line. Just corresponds one-to-one to this data type that I have. Then I have expressions. This is probably interesting if you are taking the automata and grammars course at the same time, because this is the kind of the primitive way of how do you write a parser with precedence and how do you eliminate left recursion from your parser so it doesn't loop forever. But if you are just taking this course, you know, take this as is. The grammars course will explain why you have to write it in several parts, like expression, term, and factor, and constant, and so on. And how do you combine these in a smart way that it doesn't make an infinite loop anywhere. And then there is this part which we have been focusing thus far, this parser type, and all the functions needed for applying it. So the big idea here was that the parser is a functor and applicative functor. So I can take all these how do I glue two parsers together stuff and put it in one place. It's in this star operator here. So everything that you know, I need to somehow glue parsers in a sequence, it's written there. And after this, I don't have to really talk about how the input string is cut to pieces and so on. I can just combine what I have. Then this is followed by, this is in the wrong place, the monoid instance, which does the exact same thing for alternating parsers, selecting either this thing or that other, depending on which is written in the string. And again, this is the entire code that you need to glue two parsers together in this way that they are alternating. So having a monoid instance or applicative instance, it's not really necessary for writing all the stuff that we have written. I mean, look at this piece of code. It is obvious that whenever I use this star operator here, I could just write this huge case statement. So in these two lines, there would be four huge case statements, meaning that this code would be, three screenfuls long. So the kind of the only point is to encapsulate the common parts. So I have this, star operator. I can just use it to feed function arguments into a structure. I have this pure that, lifts my function inside of structure, so I can feed it stuff. And this is a nice kind of an abstraction. It also has laws that you can go and Google for. I'm not going to go them over again. So it's kind of easy to reason about. And it's nice to read also. It says, here is my function, and it's applied this argument, it's applied that argument, and that's all fun and nice. And the fun thing is that it's like a function call with some extra noise, except that the computational context is different. So I'm not, just passing this term as an argument for my constructor. I'm creating a parser that does that for me. So kind of it's kind of nice to think of this as a, some kind of an embedded sub-language inside of Haskell. I'm just overloading this operator of how to pass arguments to a function. And then I get different kinds of behavior with that. And then I have all these tiny bits of microparsers. Let's not make that twice there. Take while something is true, parse things that are separated by other things, parse things inside parentheses, parse things that are surrounded by something. All simple, small stuff. And this is actually nice because it's completely reusable. I mean, below this point, there is nothing that relates to the actual problem at hand. This is something that you write a library for. And SAMHSA is probably going to show you an industrial strength library to do exact same thing. So this is reusable. It allows me to make this part, which I'm actually interested about, very short and very compact. Okay, the evaluator is kind of a similar kind of a thing. So this is starts to get slightly more complex. So let's take the types here so I can fit them in the same screen. I can pass programs like this. Oh, wait. Why can't I pass programs like this? Okay, I broke the parser before going this lecture. Doesn't make a width of a difference with the point of this lecture. So let's just assume that I can extract programs from strings. It seems to be there's some small mistake that I have there. It worked before I came here, but probably I did something. But okay, let's assume that that part works. Might contain other bugs that I don't know, not really important. Next thing is that we have to figure out how to evaluate this bigger statement. And this is a great example for applicative functors and even monads, because now we have the same problem as we did with the previous parser. We have lots of glue code that is starting to appear here. Because if we figure out what is the type of function that is evaluating this kind of an expression, we find many things here. For example, we have this variable. I mean, I can't evaluate my expressions without knowing the values of the variables. So I have to pass those values inside to my evaluation function. So if I start to evaluate variable of, let's say, some kind of x, what is the value of whatever variable I have? And I have to fill in something, so I have to pass an additional argument for the evaluate function. Just a quick checkup. Everyone is still in the map on what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, I have this syntax tree, which contains abstract representation of my program. I'm going to, evaluate what the program says. Clear? Okay. So, if I'm going to evaluate something like this, I have to pass in some kind of a dictionary that says what the variable values are. So, let's make a type for this, environment type. Let's choose purposefully the most inefficient representation I can think of, which is basically a list of pairs containing the variable name and the variable value. And then we look at this function. So we pass in the expression and the environment to that expression, and we get something like this. We have to figure out how to pass the environment. Then we have this small problem here. Since now we are evaluating a variable, we have to look at our environment to see what the variable value is and what we have. Well, if we have a nothing, the variable value doesn't exist, we can do plenty of things. We can return zero, for example. This is a popular choice in the older programming languages. We could return garbage, a random number, or we could just stop the program right here. No such variable is just make the program stop is the right answer, because How many of you have written a program in JavaScript, for example? Yeah, JavaScript, it actually, you know, kind of fails. It compiles if the variable is not defined, but it still fails. How many of you have written a program in ActionScript? In Flash and other things like this. That's nice because the program doesn't stop when it hits an undefined variable. It just keeps going and, you know, does a random thing that might even look a bit correct and huge mess. And if the variable is defined, I can get the value out. And what else do I have? I have variables, I have, let's add the multiplication. And then there is this let statement. Everyone is probably familiar how let statements work. And this is a more interesting thing. It should replace the value of the variable by the value of this expression. So we have to actually change our environment to pass in the new variable. So let's have a new environment. What is the new environment? It's the old environment, and we add a variable binding to it. And the variable name, well, that's given in the let statement, and the value is the value of E1. So we have to evaluate the E1 with something. Here is the curious part. Well, we have to use the old environment, so we don't get funny recursions here. We could use the new environment and get nice recursive programs, which is not actually what we want here. And then we evaluate the E2 with some piping and other things. Yep. And let's try it out. I have this example 2 here, which is a complex expression which is doing something. So in this expression, we don't have a free variable. A free variable is a variable that is not bound by the expression. Here we have two variables, x and y. Y is bound by this inner let statement, and x is bound by this outer let statement. So if we want to evaluate this, then we can just pass in an empty environment, and it should work. And what's not working is, yeah, well, probably if I reload the... Okay, now I have to extract the program from my parser result. And it gets some kind of a result. So you can probably try to calculate what this is going to be. It's going to be 7 times 4 plus 5. So we probably got it correct. So this evaluate function, it's kind of a nice function. It has same kind of a beginning of the same kind of the graph that we have in the parser case. So in this case, we have this n that is always somehow carried in the computation. So I have to remember to pass it around every time. So it's something like an expect to, you know, kind of a happen often here. It's if I change or add features to this, I'm going to have to carry around more environment around, which is probably not so nice thing. So if I make something like this, you know, or even something like this. This is actually, if you look at the code, just rename the parts, add a type parameter there to, you know, make things nice. It's starting to look like I'm having a thing which is similar to what we have had before. It's a one parameter type class, or a type constructor, or in this case just a basic type. It looks like it's a possible that this could also be a functor. And yeah, most definitely, if I have this kind of eval thing, let's say it's a function from some kind of environment to, yeah, let's have a example environment. Or example eval, which is a function from some environment to some value. Let's make a constant function, just to make things easy. So, and to make it exact what is the type of the thing. Now, this thing, I actually showed this few lectures ago. This is a functor. I can map over this thing. And now I have another function of the eval int type. I can fmap it, and I can make something that actually changes the type. Yeah, and this again matches my eval type. This would be eval string. So what is actually happening if I fmap over a function? So I have this evaluation function takes the environment. It's a constant function to make things easier. If I pass it any kind of environment, it gives me back 5. If I fmap it over with plus 1, it's hitting the result value of the function. So it's going to change the result of the function by adding 1 to the result. And the third one, if I fmap it with show, it's going to change the result of the function and make it a string. So yeah, this is a functor. It's nice. It's a functor. Then the question becomes, if I have, you know, applicative instance for this, I mean, this should be also possible, right? If I have a functor, it most likely is an applicative functor also. And we saw this again a few lectures ago. We made a monoidal instance of this, any kind of a function that is taking in the same argument. And basically, you take two functions, call both of the functions, put the results in a pair. So we already have this instance, it's in the standard library. So if I say multiply things together, I can take eval1 and eval2, they are both of this eval int type, and I can actually make this thing that works. It's an applicative functor. All functions are applicative functors in this sense. It's giving me a function that takes an environment that is, you know, it's a function. I can, you know, chip these together. The structure which contains my function is a function, which is kind of fun. And what is this thing doing? Well, if I supply an environment to it, it's returning 30. Well, it's returning whatever the eval 1 is returning, and then taking what eval 2 is returning and multiplying them together. So, okay, this should be the most mysterious part of the entire lecture. So, are you clear with this? It's not really all that complex. It's just a way if I have a function. Well, let's check the types. So if I have a function of two arguments, I put it inside of a structure. Yeah, I get the structure which is general structure, add a type, so I get this eval of int of int of int. And what is the eval int of int of int? It's actually just this. So the structure is the function, and the value inside of the structure is the return value. So this allows me to go in and start modifying my evaluate function. So let's say here I'm making lots of recursive calls. I'm not really enjoying this passing the environment around. So I can write something like this instead. And of course, in this case, I get the functions. And I still have to supply the environment here. So I can take this away soonish. So I can write it like this. This allows me to, when I'm designing this recursive thing, just forget about the environment entirely. And if I'm keen enough, I can just modify this entire function by dropping this environment totally. If I need it, I can put it on the right side of the expression. So this is the thing that you practiced in the first course in this currying example, that you can actually move these arguments from one side of the equals to another side by making them the return value into a lambda function, which means that this thing, what was inside the parentheses, it's already a function. So it already embeds the lambda environment inside. So it's easy to calculate like this. Here I can make, probably that's pure. And in this variable case, here I'm actually accessing the environment. So basically, I can't really get rid of the env lambda, or can I? I upgraded my editor. It's if you are working in Haskell, you should probably use, at least in the beginning, a program called hlint, which is a linter for Haskell. It reads a source code file and tells you that you can improve it slightly by shuffling code around a bit. And in this case, it says that, yeah, you have this case statement. It's an ugly-looking case statement. That there is this nice maybe function. Maybe is a thing that you can use to, you know, extract the value inside of a maybe by giving it the value that returns in the case that it's nothing, and the function how to transform the value if it's just. So let's figure out why I get this hint. So case statement is easy to read. Writing it in the equivalent form of maybe meaning that, you know, first case, if I have nothing, I return an error message and terminate my program. In the case I have something, I apply identity function to that. Yeah, you know, why not? I don't need to transform the result in any way. And this should be equivalent. And, well, I mean, it's harder to read. It's, at least in the beginning, it's harder to read. The case is explicit. I'm not telling you not to use cases. But in this case, if I start following the hints, they have actually a purpose. Now it says that, you know, you have a lambda function there. It's an useless lambda function. So you don't need the lambda function. Get rid of the lambda function. Then I get rid of this lambda function. And I'm using it as an argument. Okay, how do I get rid of the lambda function? Everyone is just zoning out. Yes.
Can you just remove the end and use dot after?
Yeah. Oops. I can make a composite function. Like this. Here is the idea. We have this function that eats a maybe, given some maybe, and then we have this function that produces a maybe given a string. So not a string, the environment actually. So the whole thing is a function from environment to string. So. And we get one more hint. There's this simpler function that does everything I need. And also needs to be imported. So I get this this kind of a thing. It's a nice thing. Quite simple. It doesn't mention the environment anymore. It's actually of the same type that all the other things are. So I get this nice symmetry that everything is quite cool. Except the let again. And I could start playing the same games with let, but it's probably not so nice to do. So here's the first useful applicative functor. It's the function applicative functor, also called the reader function. It is useful for passing any kind of environment to your program. So if you find yourself in a situation where you have a big program and you have to carry this, say, configuration file everywhere, you start your program, read the configuration file, it affects things inside of the program. And then you make, say, a recursive function and you always have to pass around this configuration file info. Then you can just use applicative functor and, you know, let it carry around this environment. So this is exactly the same as in the parser example. In the parser, we have to figure out how to join these small parsers, and I have this huge case statement which we use to glue together two computations. This is the same. We are having a simpler case. We have this case where we just glue together two functions that both need the same argument. But the idea is the same. The applicative D deals with the plumbing for us. It deals with the fact that we don't need to, you know, always carry around these things. And the fun part begins when we figure out that this environment thing, it's only one opportunity of this. We could do something totally different with this. So perhaps we want to fix this error thing. I mean, it would be nicer to have this eval function. I mean, it would be nice. It would be. Let's make a copy of this so I don't ruin my example. It would be nice that we could use this eval function in our program in some other ways. It's now hard to program around this evaluate function. Let's suppose that we are making an interpreter for our language, this imaginary small language, a bit like GHC. And then someone types unknown variable to this program interpreter or calculator, and the whole thing crashes. It's definitely not what we want. We should print an error message and then continue as we should. So let's make another variant of this evaluate function. Call it evaluate2. And, well, I really should have kept the original form, but, well, who cares? So, let's start from what we actually had, even though it means just returning this to the original state, just backtracking our steps a bit. Just to check if this works. Yep. So, okay. Let's try again. In the first case, we did small amount of work. We got rid of the extra environment argument. Let's make a different kind of a thing. Let's use this kind of a type. So instead of just failing the program, let's return either string or the value, string being the error message. So again, we can just start editing our program. Now each of these branches should return either string or an A. So, well, the variables, they are easy. No. In case of nothing, I get this, and that's going to go to the left branch of my thing, and whatever I have is, if I find it, it's going to the right branch. Also, if I have a constant, it's going to be a correct value. And now I get to this deep trouble here. Let's comment out this. And this is nasty. Because now this value E1, well, this probably doesn't exist, or it might not exist. So what happens if something probably or possibly doesn't exist? Well, we get this dance that we have been doing. Yeah, I have to change the code a bit more than I thought. This part goes. So instead of this nice nice function that I just added something to a list, I get a case statement. No, oh, that's nasty. So let's see what happens here. I have something plus something else. Both of the evaluate calls can now fail, so I have to do this. If this fails, then I just error out. If it does not fail, then I check if the second environment fails. Okay, I have to write this. Then I have you know, two more of these, so I have to repeat myself again and again and again. And I heard someone yawning already. So what am I supposed to do right now? It's a puzzle, all right. It's not nice. At least if I think of how I would implement this minus operator, like this, and totally unacceptable. I mean, I have to write the same what 5 lines of code over and over again, and of these, you know, 5 lines, the only important part is this one symbol here. That makes all the difference. So this is getting out of hand. I mean, it's just impossible to write a bigger interpreter with this technique. So let's figure out what is possible to do again. So eval2, guess what this is? It's eval2int. It's again a functor, it's an applicative functor. You know, easily. All ithers are, they are functors. I can use something like this. I can this is already predefined. This is one good exercise that you can do. Define applicative instance for either. And how does it work? If we check the behavior through this monoidal definition that we have, and this is a very good tool to understand applicatives. Either, if we replace we would have this kind of a function. And obviously, we have two either values, either x a, either x b. First one can contain an a, and second one can contain a b, or they can contain an x instead. And then I have to return an either x containing a and a b. And the semantics are instantly obvious. If I do not have an a, then I can never have pair of A and B. And likewise for B. If it doesn't exist, I can't make this pair. So if either of these is left, it contains the X instead of the string, then the result must also contain the X instead. So this is kind of a, it's usually used for cases which can fail. So as you can see from the example, using the true applicative instance here, it tries to apply plus to these values, and if I write it out, it's like this. Pure is just the right, and so on. It tries to feed this function plus, which is inside the either structure. It tries to feed it an argument. The argument is left foo. There is no number in this thing. So it cannot feed this plus function. It's impossible to get a value that can go into the plus. So the result must also be the left side of the computation, because there is no value that can be given as the first argument to this plus. So it has to be the failure case. So in this case, it's kind of a short-circuiting computation. Whenever there is a left, the whole thing collapses into that said left value. You can, you know, find analogs in other languages. Think about, let's say, if you have a loop in C sharp, and then you say break. I mean, that's kind of the same behavior as here. The break is the left constructor, and it's used to terminate everything and just return that value. I think some languages have constructs like break width, or, you know, C sharp's return 17. And that stops your loop right there, and the whole computation is of value 17. It's like a premature return. So again, I can start fooling around with these things by using the applicative notation. So let's get rid of that and figure out what happens here. So I have the function that I want to apply here. It's a plus. Plus is a nice function. And then I can start feeding it arguments. First argument is what I get from evaluating this left-hand side of the plus, and the second is, yeah, much nicer. Yeah. And here's my language evaluator again. So now I just extracted the, let's do this, write that as a pure, and that can stay as it is. The let, that case, well, I can use that also in, or use my applicative notation also here. I can just extract this let thingy here and make it into a lambda and feed the arguments to there. But I don't think I bother to do it with this yet. I can just probably skip it entirely for a while. So if you look at this part of the code, it's, you know, we have this pure and this applicative idiom there. And then we have the exact same structure here. So the point what I'm chasing after is that by changing this return value, using some other data type as the return value, like either or a function, I can pretty much decide how this computation is going to be calculated. So now I have a computation that can fail with an error message. Here I have a computation that has an implicit environment. So it has a kind of a, you know, global static parameter on top of it. So you can have different kinds of these, you know, funny things. So okay, any questions at this point? It's quite simple. Simple toy. Everyone is, you know, on the map still, in the same country, at least in this. There's nothing really difficult about this. It has some syntactic noise because of the pure and this star operator, but basically pure takes a function, puts it inside of a computational context, and the star feeds values from another computational context to the previous one. So, no problem there. Okay, then. Minkä näistä tämän?
Siihen laittaa dollarin tilalle ja ottaa sen pureen pois.
Oh, yes. The question for the video is, could I get rid of the pure by inserting a dollar here? This leads me to believe that at least someone has programmed in Haskell for a bit longer than this course. I can make this. Did you mean this?
Yeah.
Great. So, what is this? Why? Another operator. Well, to may show you what this operator actually is, it's fmap. Fmap has this funny name, so that's the same thing. And how does this work? If I fmap over evaluate 1 with a plus, plus takes 2 arguments, the fmap applies it to result of evaluate e1, giving me a eval that contains a function of 1 argument, which is what I shove in with this star operator here. So yeah, it's a bit nicer like this. Bit more confusing since now you don't see the pure anywhere. It's a bit awkward there. Okay, what is the immediate question? I have these two bits of code. One is passing around the environment and one is taking care of the failures. So what is the immediate next thing that everyone would like to do in this situation? Yeah, combine them. And this is actually, it's kind of theoretically interesting and also because I have two things here. I mean, I have conceptually, I would like to have something like type like this. I have one eval and then the other eval, and it should, is it an applicative functor if I just jam these together? And well, I could spend 15 minutes on the blackboard proving that if you take any two applicative functors and nest them, the result is also an applicative functor. But since this appears in all the articles about applicative functors, it's not a useful thing to do. So we take that as a, we just believe that this happens. It does not happen with monads anymore. So if you take two monads and compose them, it's probably not a monad anymore. But the applicative functors, they are nice. They are very nice with this. And I showed you this. Do I have? Yes, here. Okay, remember this guy. This strange thing. What did this do? This was the first or second lecture. Anyone recall this compose guy? Yeah. What did it do? What is your understanding of how this works? Well, it's let's take an example. So if I fmap over and if I have this kind of a statement, does this work? Will the numbers change? Hand up if the numbers don't change, in your opinion. Hand up if they do change. Okay. So, I think we have hit a snatch here. The numbers don't change because this function here, let's see if I can get to use this underscore trick. What is the type of the function if I want to fmap over this kind of a list? What is the type of the function I can use? And it's, maybe integer to whatever I like. From maybe integer. So if I try to do this, it's, not, doesn't contain a maybe. So this would be a type error, because this fmap, it's hitting the maybe value. it's going one step inside to the structure and not two steps. So if I want to do this, I have to do something like fmap over the list and fmap each element of the list, and this works. I can somehow, you know, first fmap penetrates the list, second penetrates the maybes, and then the function operates there. Okay, then I showed you another way to do this. I have this compose functor. Here we have a compose functor we constructed with the constructed C. F is the list, G is the maybe, and now if I fmap it, now I can hit these numbers inside of a list, inside of a maybe. Okay, now everyone recalls what this compose is. And, well, this is actually predefined. This is something that plenty of people use when often. So let's use it in our program. So this is exactly the same thing that I wrote. It has more type annotations, so actually kind annotations. It's defined a bit differently. The constructor name is compose, and it's using the record syntax, we get this get compose thing. So we can try to see if we can make even a nicer evaluator function. And I think if I leave the let out of it for a while, it's going to be just easier. It's a nice exercise work to put it back in. And then we use eval3. And then we have to figure out what is this eval3 type. What's the type? And did I call it eval1 or just eval? Just eval. I can make this kind of a composition. And why not? Well, I've been talking 1 hour non-stop, so I can get confused. So why not? So if I have a function like this, and then go and compose it, it should work rather nicely. So this should be a function that takes the environment, yes, and this should be either string. Yeah, great. Now, for some reason I made a mistake with the type aliases. Everyone familiar with this thing? Two people are nodding and the rest are trying to hide. Hands up if you know what this arrow in brackets means. So what is this? Consider a ordinary Haskell program, 1 plus 3, or Haskell expression. This is an addition. I can do plenty of things. I can write it like this. using this conversion to from operator to function notation, or infix to prefix. This is the same thing. So then if I make a thing like this, I get, again, a function that is missing the other argument, which is actually the same as this. And this is the exact same thing that I do with the types. I have A arrow B. I can always write this as the arrow in parentheses AB. Right. This is, you know, exactly analog. And then I can drop the A from there. And from some nasty syntactical reason, I can't write it like this. Doesn't accept it. So it's not completely analogous. So this is, says, all functions from domain of A. A is the domain of these functions. They can end up anywhere. You supply the type parameter telling me where they end up. So it's a function starting from this point. And now, back to this. So in this part, we have to start fiddling around a bit. So let's drop the environment, for example. It's no longer needed. It's automatically supplied by this composition applicative. And here we can't really be that, you know, specific. We have to actually insert the environment here. Yep. Looks a bit like the original form that I had. And now this code, it incorporates, you know, almost. Oh, yeah. Have to shuffle in the necessary stuff. Okay, let's see if I can figure out what's wrong here. Oh, reload here, get the... What? Oh yeah, wrong file. Yeah, of course. And that's a hazard of talking and writing, you know, at the same time. I had a bit too much there. So and the entire code works as is, except for the let, in which I have to actually get the environment out of the function. Before we attack this, is the philosophy clear? So I have things that actually do something. Things like, you know, plus or minus. And then I have this computational context, which defines how I compute with these things. For example, if I add things that can possibly be non-existent, like the evaluatory E1, it might refer to undefined variable and thus not have a value. Then my applicative framework, the computational context, tells me how do I combine values that are inside of an iter or inside of a function. So all the plumbing is done inside the this applicative instances. And the code that is we use to write our business logic or the logic of the application, it can look exactly the same. We can just, you know, in this case, I think I can replace. Now, with very small changes, I mean, this variable lookup, this I have to change if I change the computational context. This part where I add numbers, I'm not doing anything with the context. This can stay the same, regardless of whatever I do. This can be just the same. So, that's another example of applicative functors. Very nice tools. Any questions or comments? Yeah. Compose, let's. And yeah, plenty of instances. Compose, it's a new type. It has this constructor compose, and it's defined like this. If I have f of g of a, this is a type. Yeah, you can think of f as a maybe and g as a list. You get, you know, maybe a list of a's. So it's just a, you know, new type wrapper for things that look like this. Nothing else. It's a new type wrapper contains a functor that contains another functor and some values inside. And then it has all these nice instances. So if both f and g are functors and I'm composing them together, then the result of the composition is also a functor which does this mapping inside the both of these structures. And also it has, well, it's pretty much everything you could expect. For example, if both of these f and g are applicative functors, then the result is applicative functor. And nicely, if both of these are foldable, you know, you can say fold and then your monoids will hit things nicely. They are foldable and so on, all the useful stuff. For example, where did I have it? This, I can. If I have compositions of some things, I can fold inside these compositions. So if I have some monoid that I want to use to reduce the entire nested structure, I can just reduce the entire nested structure. It's a very handy thing. It also is one of these things that it really, in the beginning, takes time to, you know, figure out where I can use these. It's finding these f of g's of a's in a type, it's harder than it seems. I mean, here it's a bit, you know, slightly artificial in my example, but it's a nice example. It's still a, you know, borderline natural thing to do. Okay, then we can start playing this with this. So did I have a some expression that is interesting enough without being a let? Let's do this. Example expression. If I run a parser and, well, basically I get this. What? Well, this is weird. Oh, well, totally different session. So, well, anyways, I can just try again. So, yeah, I have this expression, then I have this syntax tree, and I can evaluate this. Syntax tree, I have an empty environment. It gives me an exception. I can use the evaluate to. It says left, no such variable. And I have this evaluate tree, which is and to get actually the result out of this, I need to, since it's a new type, I have to, use getCompose to get the thing inside compose constructor, and here I have it. So this is how you can use all of these. And if I make a definition, say x is 10, I can get a value for this. So this is kind of nice. I have this left and a right, they are nice applicative functors. There's nice amount of structure inside. So let's see if I can play with this little more. I have 15 minutes, I can show you fun things. So now I have this evaluate tree sans the let statement. I'm probably going to just fill in it after the lecture. Let's make more evaluates or evals. So let's make, we have this composition. Let's make eval 4, which is some other applicative functor. So let's make something fun. Let's make, what functors do we have? We have maybe, but that would be almost the same as either. So that's boring. We used either already. We used function already. What other applicative functors do we know of other functors? Well, the most obvious functor, the list. List is nice. So now we get something that is pretty interesting. So we have this our toy example. If we comment out the part that we are actually using this environment, which is in the variable evaluation, the whole code works. There's no problem with that, I think, except the redundant brackets. So now instead of looking up the x from the environment, let's make the environment an actual argument again, so we don't have to work with it too much. Then this has to be bit edited. And of course, I wouldn't need to actually do this. It's just for convenience sake that I can demonstrate the exact thing that I'm talking about and not all of this together. Probably easier to read. So back to this It is apparent that I get, asymptotically slower as the lecture goes on. I'm making more and more errors, so let's see. Yeah, now I have working code. So, I have a list, this applicative functor. What is a pure, it's just a function that puts a single thing in a list. And that's simple. And the variable. So what do I need to return here? I need to return a list of some values, and I get the values from the environment. I also get the variable names and the variable values. Let's be more exact. And add a condition that, you know, x has to be the name. So basically, instead of selecting one variable from the environment, if there are multiple x's in the environment, we just do it for all of them. In this case, it's nice that I have commented out the let, because the semantics of let become pretty hairy in this kind of a case, because I just, you know, do I have to add the new variable? Do I have to remove the old variable? And things like this. But let's see. I have evaluate for reload and then nastily, since, I mean, if anyone would fix this in GHC, I would pay money for it. I have to rebind all the variables because reloading just threw them all away. And I have evaluate for, and if I pass it an environment that x is bound, then let's but I can also make multiple bindings, so it returns all the results it gets to me. And what do I have here? This is kind of a, you know, non-deterministic computation, because I can make, let's say, in my, you know, dummy language, I could make some thing like if statement. It would be easy to program there. Then I could make a operator that says fail, which would turn into an empty list. And then I would say that, you know, here is a program, here are the equations that it must solve, and x must be in this range, and then run the program, and it would, you know, take a long time to run, but it would return me the initial assignment of the variables that give the result that I'm looking for from the program. So it's like a reverse programming. So okay, I can add more. And this is probably simple. I just change the applicative functor, change the bits that touch the computational environment, and then everything else stays the same. I had a smarter example of the next topic that I'm going to show you. But first, before going into that, any questions about this? So there's two levels that I'm talking about. One is this toy language that I'm building. By adding this different kind of applicative functors on top of this evaluator allows me to make different semantics for my toy language. It allows me to, you know, somehow return failure cases better. It allows me to make non-deterministic languages, whatever applicative functor I think of, and just write the evaluate based on that. I can make a different kind of programming language. But this programming language that we are making, this toy that we have here, it's not in any way related to these applicative functors. They are just completely general. They are just, this these operators, they don't care that they are in some toy language interpreter. You can use this in any Haskell program that you have, meaning that the actual Haskell program gains the same abilities as the interpreted program. So if I make this evaluate for which in which I use lists as an applicative functor, that is an exercise work. Figure out how lists are applicative functors. I have this code. These bits of code here, they behave as if the computational context of Haskell is this non-deterministic. You can, you know, run the code for all possible value combinations. It's like your entire code is inside a list comprehension. So, and it's kind of nice. You don't have to have this interpreted language that you are fiddling with. You can just write ordinary Haskell code, use this applicative syntax, and then decide how it's evaluated. I mean, this bit of code can be evaluated in whatever way you like. It can be evaluated so that it returns, in some cases, a failure. It can be evaluated so that it returns all the possible combinations of the inputs. It can be evaluated so that it's, what else, returns a maybe. It's actually changing how the Haskell functions are interpreted. So if you want something like, you know, let's say a variable inside. You want to use a changing variable, like a Java variable in your Haskell program. Well, you can just make an applicative functor that does this for you. You can have an applicative functor that is emulating some kind of a hidden state. So basically, I could make programs like this. I intended to, you know, be so fast that I can write an interpreter for this programs also, but not going to get that far here. Probably going to do that also after this lecture. So if I have things like this, I have this, assignment statement. I say that x is equal to x plus 5 in the Java sense that you read the value of x, add 5 to it, and put it back using the same name. So this would need another kind of computational context. It's so-called state monad or state functor. Basically looks like something like this. It's a rather simple thing. Looks a bit like our parser. Our parser is actually a special case of this kind of. It's any kind of a function which contains a modifiable Java kind of a variable is actually a function from this internal state of the program into a pair which contains the return value of the function and the new state. So this allows you to thread mutable variables through your code, at least single mutable variable. And since the time is so short, I will actually define this during the next lecture and just show how it works. State is so old invention that it was invented before applicative functors. Monads came first, applicatives the second. So that's why the module name is what it is. So I could make another version of this. And then instead of the environment, I can make a changing environment. I could make what did I call my environment? Env, yeah. 3 minutes, I'm not going to be able to make that. But, well, okay, well, 3 minutes, too little time. Probably better to just leave it off at this point and then do the state properly next time. So no need to get ahead of myself, because the state is a natural springboard to monads. Because state as an applicative functor, it's a bit, you know, silly, since we can put stuff in mutable variables, we can take stuff from mutable variables, and then we hit the absolute limit of applicative functors. We can't do ifs on what is inside this variable. We can't, you know, change the structure of the computation based on the variable that we get from our state. And monads allow us to do that. And that's the prelude for the next lecture. Any questions at this point? No. I have one. Grading of how confused you are right now, meaning everything is clear, understand perfectly. I'm not sure if I'm coming back here ever. So what's the status right now? It's on the yellow range, I think. Okay, but thank you, and we see each other again on Tuesday. And that's the conclusion of this.